Tutu.
Hubbo.
Tutu.
Hubbo.
Have you seen that post I put there on your deal you just commented on?
Yeah, did
They're really taking that thing to Hobbs, New Mexico.
Are you kidding me?
Look up at the top of it. It tells on that little deal it tells to Hobbs.
Yeah, I'm loading the thing right now. How much time do we have there, Hobbo?
Hobbs.
That is so great. Hobbs, New Mexico. That's like the best thing ever.
Hobbs.
We're taking it straight to Hobbs.
Mexico Department of Transportation and Mexico State Police are helping transport a military aircraft to Hobbs.
That is the best thing ever.
It's a spooky looking little outfit, isn't it?
Well, what's so funny is, yeah, I'm loading this story right now. Strange looking aircraft turns heads in Moriarty. Oh my God, are you kidding? Beth Arcee.
Bill's Bass Fishing Boat.
That picture, that's exactly what it
looks like. It should say Uncle Bill's Boss Bass Fishing Boat.
It does look like a fishing boat, doesn't it? I mean, you can look through the motor, everything. El Caliuche, the phantom vessel of Chiloé Island.
<I'm sorry.
sighs> Oh, man. I need more coffee. Actually, I don't need more coffee. That's a problem. Normally, this day, I don't drink coffee so late in the day.
Every minute counts.
Especially when you... Hobbs.
When you're fighting Uncle Sam.
You doing okay, Hobbo?
Yeah, I was just watching the video, man, of Manning retiring.
Yeah, that's the big story tonight. That's topic A, which is why I won't be addressing it on the program tonight.
I love that album, man.
What is that album?
The Wall by Michael Jackson. I still today think it's one of the greatest albums ever made.
I like The Wall. I'm going to build a wall. I love The Wall. It's going to be good.
The wall just got 10 feet higher. We do good deals. All right, man. We've got a minute and 15 seconds before we go live, man. I didn't know when you had to restart those updates how much time to put in the how much time that I needed to add in commercial stop set, so I just laid it to it.
It's A-okay. In the words of Dark Man, that'll be just fine.
Boy, look at the globe. It is lit up for the Mike and Hank Show.
That's right, because the globe loves me. Globe Theater, that is.
Comunidad de Madrid.
Home the boogie one chesimino. Tata, 50 tata for the Wookiee.
Zitatu, Germany. They're all over the place for the Hanks, even way down in South Australia.
And all this time we've been wondering, where they at, though?
Here they come in three.
Oh, hold on.
Two.
Hold on.
The planet.
What do you mean, hold on? You ready?
Almost. Hang on.
We're ready to go live, Micah.
Okay. We can do it. I mean, hey, count me down.
Ready?
Yeah.
All right. Hobbs, Hobbs, and Hobbs, Hobbs. Two, one. We're live.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Gremium Bunker, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Gremium Report. As we bring you dispatches from beyond the fringe, as I sit here behind Gremium Master Studios console in the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains. Boy, have we got a program for you tonight from the mountains all the way down to the sea. My good buddy Jason Pentrail will be joining us during the second hour. We're going to be talking about ancient sea monsters. Could there still be creatures lurking out there in the ocean depths to this day? You know, a lot of biologists think that very well may be the case. Now, Jason has a very unique perspective on this subject. We're going to get his thoughts during the second hour, as well as a few from you here during hour one, and all the latest news that's happening around the world as we broadcast to you, to all friendly folks in the free world, via www.kgraradio.com, our home, our hub, right here on the World Wide Web. So glad, so stoked, in fact, to be here. You know, I can catch the scent of the grass and the soil opening up as the warm weather is beginning to arise. You know, they always say, in like a lion, out like a lamb. Especially here in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. Well, it can waver and change from day to day, but it has been beautiful today. And our honorary Graylian, Smokey Waddell, and I went and had lunch today, celebrating his birthday, which was actually a few days ago, but usually, you know, again, time travel. It's relative whether or not I'm on time or there where I need to be, but better late than never. So we went and we had lunch, and then we had coffee, and then I caught up with Jason a bit before tonight's show, going over what all we'd talk about. Fascinating guy. Really, really looking forward to bringing him onto this program and introducing him to the Graylian listenership. But it is just so beautiful in Asheville right now. I cannot be anything but energized. And of course, that whole energy thing has a lot to do with who you have around you. And that's why I'm always happy to have back in Master Control, the producer extraordinaire of this program and the man you know and love as Hobbo, Mr. Race Hobbs. How are you tonight, sir?
I am doing so, Hobbs, tonight. Just want to reach out across the planet, Micah, if I could real quick, and give a shout out to all the listeners tuning in to you right now, all the way from Glasgow, Scotland, and Germany, and Spain, and Australia, from Vancouver, Canada, all the way down to Phoenix, Arizona, LA, all the way up to Maine. They're just all over. Even Honolulu, Hawaii is chiming in tonight. And I just want to say hi to all of you and thank all of you for coming on to the KGRA every Monday to kick off a great week of talk radio with Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
Boy, I couldn't have said it better myself, Hobbs.
Well, Hobbs, you know, I just enjoy being here, and thank you for bringing me in on such a prestigious program.
Oh, gosh. Wow, Hobbs. You know, it's incredible because I'm looking at the Twitter machine right now. Yeah, I've got folks from Glasgow, Scotland, people from down under in Australia. My good buddy Dan James, hoping he makes it back up to the States again so we can catch up for coffee and maybe a touch of brunch just as well. Who knows, maybe we'll even take Uncle Bill's bass fishing boat out for a ride. What do you think, Race? Because I think that it was taking a little trip through New Mexico recently. You know what I'm talking about.
On its way to Hobbs.
Yes, it was. No joke, folks. This is true. A strange-looking aircraft has been turning heads in Moriarty on the heels of my Sherlock Holmes-themed Graylian X program that we aired over the weekend, which is funny because, interestingly, Beth Arzee was standing at the rail station listening to that, and she said that Baker Street was playing on the loudspeakers there in the station as she was listening to the Sherlock Holmes podcast I did.
Jerry Rafferty.
What?
Amazing.
Oh, yes, 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 of course. And so here's the story I'm going to air, and you'd put this up on my Facebook page about a strange-looking aircraft turning heads in Moriarty, of course, citing the name of the infamous Holmesian villain. But what's funny is, yeah, this object has been seen, and apparently the New Mexico Department of Transportation and state police have been helping transport some sort of a military craft. It's got a tarp over it, so you can't see a whole lot, and they're taking it, yes, to Hobbs. That's where it's going. It's going to Hobbs.
Hobbs, New Mexico.
Laden with conspiracies.
It is laden with Hobbs.
Yes, well, if nothing else, it's laden with synchronicity. So, yeah, what's been reported by KOAT.com is that the New Mexico Department of Transportation and New Mexico State Police are helping transport this vehicle to Hobbs. But when the craft made a stop at the TA truck stop in Moriarty on Saturday, the plane got stares and stirred questions from onlookers. But again, from the side, it says here, some said it looked like a boat. That's what I was saying. It looks like Uncle Bill's bass fishing boat, you know, with the tarp over it. Glad to know what our butt... Go ahead.
It does have an odd shape. It does. It's not like, you know, the drones, you know, that we mistake for, or those have mistaked for UFOs. It has a really just bizarre shape to it. I don't know. I have no idea what it could be.
I'll tell you what it resembles. From what we can see, and it's a little difficult to tell the general size, but on the back of this flatbed, I would gather that it's probably roughly the size of, you know, I mean, the, well, I guess roughly the size of a standard flatbed carrier, you know, that an 18-wheeler would use for transportation. The shape is somewhat like the fuselage of something along the lines of the SR-71 Blackbird. Not quite, but again, that's from a very vague photograph, viewing it from just one angle. I'm surprised nobody said flying saucer yet, though. You know, last time that they carried one of the Navy's XF-7Bs through Washington, D.C., people were taking pictures and saying, oh my gosh, they're transporting a flying saucer through Washington. which would be only the second time in history that that UFOs have apparently allegedly descended over the nation's capital, right? The first time being back in the 50s.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Well.
Very odd indeed.
Very odd indeed. Yes, almost as odd. By the way, you know, last week we talked a little bit about Trump, and not by droves, but there have been a few people, you know, like I knew would happen if you mention politics, people start writing you. They want to make sure that you know that they are not going to ever listen to your program again because you touched on something, you know, apart from silliness and weird stuff. But, you know.
Well, for all of those who are not listening to the program tonight, we appreciate you taking the time to write the program. And thank you for coming and listening to the program tonight.
It is a great program. It's a great program. I love programs.
But it does great deals.
Well, I want to give, you know, equal and fair shakes at all of the trash talkers, liars, politicians, mudslingers, and mudrakers out there. Okay, in the American political sphere. So let's talk about Hillary Clinton a little bit tonight, yeah? Make sure that we make everybody as angry as we can. No, I'm kidding. Here's the headline, though, that the Mirror carried. It's an update on a story that we've carried already once. Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, actually, is the focus of this one, convincing her to release secret UFO files if elected. This is what's been reported. Again, we report it here as a continuation of a previously discussed program point on this program, because it's a program about those kind of things. Program. Okay. Hillary Clinton is fast becoming the Democratic Party's front runner for the U.S. presidential election. Well, I don't know. Frankly, I was looking at the debate returns the other night, or not debate, but the election returns on Saturday. Sanders is doing pretty well. That, to me, is being extraordinarily underreported. Just saying. But the focus of this article is looking at John Podesta, who has said he, quote, convinced Clinton to tell the world about the UFO and ET phenomena. Now, the long-term advocate of ending excessive secrecy seems to have struck a chord with his boss, who has pledged to get to the bottom of it and have a task force go to Area 51. Again, I don't know how effective that would be in unraveling the UFO mystery, but I digress. Now, Podesta, who has been the advisor, specifically I'm talking about the Area 51 task force thing, and frankly, when Clinton said that, I'm not so sure I took that incredibly seriously, although I do know that Podesta is dead serious about, you know, attaining some level of disclosure if Clinton is to make it to the office of president. So now he's a long-term advocate of ending excessive secrecy, and he seems to have struck a chord with his boss, Clinton, who has pledged to get to the bottom of it. Podesta, who has been an advisor to U.S. Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama since 1993, says the former First Lady has listened to his pleas for all government-held UFO files to be made readily available to the public. Now, it's one thing if she's asked about it. It's another thing if Podesta says, I have appealed to her, and this is what she has told me. So here is what he has said most recently about this. During an interview with Steve Sebelius, co-host of KLAS television Politics Now, based out of Las Vegas, he said, I've talked to Hillary about that, UFOs presumably, and I think I've convinced her that we need an effort to declassify as much as we can so people can have their legitimate questions answered. More attention and discussion about unexplained aerial phenomena can happen without people who are in public life who are serious about this being ridiculed. It is not the first time, of course, that the White House Chief of Staff has called the U.S. government to come clean on what it knows about aliens. Last year, he tweeted with his biggest disappointment, and this was a famous tweet at that time, was of course, he was in the process of leaving his position at that time as one of Obama's advisors, but he'd said in a tweet, one of his biggest disappointments was, quote, once again not securing the disclosure of the UFO files. Hashtag disclosure, ladies and gentlemen. You can't follow me, but, you know, it'd be interesting to see people tossing the disclosure hashtag around tonight as we discuss some of this. Now, back in 2010, he wrote the foreword to journalist Leslie Kane's book also, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. And I have to say that that is probably one of the most significant UFO books of the new century. And in fact, I think probably one of the most significant UFO books probably the last three decades just as well. For those who have not read it, and I do own a copy, it actually covers a lot more than just the United States UFO phenomena. If you're interested in UFOs in a more broad, both political and also, you know, geographical sense, that book will give you a very interesting perspective on things. And yet I still see people, I've seen people writing, you know, again, these reviews lambasting the book, you know, debunking the entire thing. So like Marcello Truzzi said back in the 80s, I left PSYCOP, he did, Committee for Scientific Investigation for Claims of the Paranormal. He said, I left the organ, and he was a co-founder. Okay, but Marcello Truzzi, a sociologist, quite a bright fellow, by the way, I think, too, you know, truly someone I admire. Truzzi said, I left PSYCOP because he said, as much as there were open-minded skeptics, you know, amidst our ranks, He said there was a preponderance of those who had this attitude that if 90% of UFO cases could be debunked, well, then why not 100? Which is a fairly unfortunate position to take. I could understand why people could get so locked into a position of skepticism that they would take that kind of an approach. And frankly, I was talking with my friend Jason, who we'll be hearing from in the second hour tonight, on the phone earlier today, and he had even said, you know, I guess it's going to take a few decades before we can really get on track with UFOs in any kind of an innovative capacity, because he says, really, it has become such a cultural staple that UFO equals alien. He says it's going to be hard for us to get around that. And I said, you know, I agree with you. I really do. I think that efforts could be made now to really kind of, again, in an epistemological sense, come back off of the subject, take a step back, say, okay, look, how do we know what we know? Are we really sure that we're dealing mostly with aliens here, or mostly with secret government craft, or really, again, with an item that is a worthy discussion subject as it relates to government secrecy? Sure, I think that that's a big part of it. But, you know, like I was talking to Sam last week on the program, Sam Roberts, the young journalist who brought to our attention this FOIA request, and there's been some updates. I got an email just before we went to air. I probably won't have time to get to all of it on this week's show, maybe next one. But he offered some interesting points in relation to the FOIA request that Sam brought to our attention last week in relation to the A-10 Warthogs operating over the Barry Goldwater Range at the time of the Phoenix Lights observation. Another quick anecdote about that. I'm meeting Mark Brady, our Graylian, chief Graylian newsy, really. I mean, he sends so much stuff every week, every day, in fact. But I'm going to be meeting him and his wife for dinner on Wednesday, and they both were in Phoenix and saw the lights at the time that that was actually underway, the Phoenix Lights incident. So I can't wait to talk to Mark about that, and of course you guys will be hearing about that on this program just as well. But anyway, all that aside, when I was talking to Sam last week, I'd said one of the issues that we face with disclosure, of course, is that, well, if government is holding information that it really feels is something of great enough a security interest that it should not, at least at this time, possibly ever, be released to the public, and we keep petitioning to the public, or rather to the government, for release of information, well, you know, it realistically may be the case that we will never get the kind of information we're hoping for. Second, another important point that has to be made to the disclosure crowd is that what we think the government may be withholding may not be the reality. I'm sure that there's some information that is being withheld. But I also think that in terms of, and John Alexander, Stanton Friedman, of all, you know, all these researchers have talked about this over the years, whether they all agree on all points. The aforementioned Stan and John, they don't really agree on all points, but they certainly have, you know, individually a lot of knowledge about such things as need to know. I know that when Jimmy Carter went to then CIA Director George Herbert Walker Bush and said, you know, I'd like to, you know, see if I can get information about UFOs, he was told, then, you know, active President of the United States was told by the CIA Director, who would go on to become President of the United States, he was told at that time, sir, you don't have a need to know for that information. And if we keep that in mind, even if John Podesta, you know, again, he appeals to Hillary Clinton, let's say that she beats Donald Trump or whoever else, she's elected to president, even someone like Hillary Clinton, she could find herself in the exact same place as Carter did, and no doubt as others have, as in fact her husband had. Again, he said when he was talking to Jimmy Kimmel, we've featured this audio on the program a few times, he has said actually in many interviews that, hey, you know, yeah, I did look into Area 51. Hey, yeah, you know, I did look into the Kennedy assassination, sort of, he said, you know, looking into all these kinds of things. And he said, yeah, if I had that information, if I'd found evidence of a cover-up, or if I had that kind of information, yeah, I would have released it to the public if it was within my power to do so, or if I had access to that information. And I do think that in large part, you know, I'll tell you what, let's do. Just for sake of having a thorough discussion about this, it's worthy of revisiting exactly what Bill Clinton said about that. I actually want to go back to this. Then we'll come back around to the idea of whether or not the United States president, the commander-in-chief, would actually have that, you know, that level of clearance or need to know in order to be able to even gain access to UFO documents. But let's go back. This is what Clinton said last year about this subject.
If I was president, and I won't be, let's be honest, the first thing I would do after putting my hand on that Bible and taking that oath to serve the country is I wouldn't even probably finish the oath. I would run to the White House. I'd demand to see all the classified files on the UFOs. Because I want to know. I'd want to know what has been going on. Did you do that?
Sort of.
Sort of.
Yeah, we had I think it was at the beginning of my second term, we had the anniversary of Roswell.
You waited that long?
I did.
Wow.
Well, I didn't. And then there's also Area 51. You remember there was a great sci-fi movie where there was an alien kept deep under the ground
in
Area 51? So first I had people go look at the records on Area 51 to make sure there was no alien down there. And people thought that because everybody who works there has to stop about an hour away and put on special clothing and then drive in and out. And that's because a lot of our stealth technology is made there. We know that now. But there are no aliens there. So then when the Roswell thing came up, I knew we'd get, you know, gazillions of letters. So I had all the Roswell papers reviewed, everything.
If you saw that there were aliens there, would you tell us?
Yeah.
You would.
I would. Well, I think, look, what do we know? We know now we live in an ever-expanding universe. We know that there are billions of stars and planets literally out there, and the universe is getting bigger. We know from our fancy telescopes that just in the last 2 years, more than 20 planets have been identified outside our solar system that seem to be far enough away from their suns and dense enough that they might be able to support some form of life. So it makes it increasingly less likely that we're alone.
Oh, you're trying to give me a hint that there are aliens.
No, I'm trying to tell you I don't know.
Oh.
But if we were visited someday, I wouldn't be surprised. I just hope that it's not like Independence Day.
Yeah, right.
That it's a conflict.
Well, now we have friendly.
Maybe
aliens.
The only way to unite this incredibly divided world of ours. They're out there. We better think of how all the differences among people on Earth would seem small if we felt threatened by a space invader. That's the whole theory of Independence.
You're right. You're
Everybody
right.
Everybody gets together and makes nice and.
You and Bill O'Reilly would be hiding in a bunker together.
Which is truly probably the most terrifying aspect of that entire audio soundbite. But again, revisiting what Clinton has said, it's obvious that there have been commander-in-chiefs in the past, or commanders-in-chief. I have to check my Associated Press style guide, make sure I state this correctly. That or 150 more people will email me between the next 7 days and tell me or correct me, which I always rely on you guys to do. But that said, again, the question, and I actually just tweeted this out, so if you'd like to interact with me on this, you can actually follow me at Mike Hanks on Twitter. The question I pose, would the U.S. president, sworn in next year, whomever is elected, would they be able to access information withheld from the public on UFOs? If we are to look at this as a matter of historical precedent, how have things played out in the past, and is it likely that whoever is elected next will be able to do it? I am not so sure. Which leads us to a couple of more questions. Well, how sure are we that there's information being withheld about UFOs? My gut tells me there probably is. It may not be what many of us think it is, but I still doubt that whatever that is something accessible even to the Commander-in-Chief. What's that tell you about it? We'll pick it up on the other side of this break. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. What did I tell you? I told you they would correct me. You don't think they exist. I'm here to tell you. There is a covert operation. And they are out there. They're watching. They're listening to every word I say. And they just tweeted at me, in fact. Grammar Police, Micah Hanks, I feel that you have miswritten a status update and should have used the year whoever, not whomever, is elected instead. Thank you, Grammar Police. Whew. Wow, I'm glad they're listening, I guess. Glad you guys are listening, by the way, just as well. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Coming back off the heels of what we were talking about in the last segment as it relates to the President of the United States being able to have need to know as it relates to the subject of UFOs. Todd Masura tweets, Micah, no, that has been shifted from the military and alphabet soup agencies. It's in the hands of private contractors now. No FOIA. My buddy Jacob writes, I think the Clintons have preyed on people that believe in UFOs and constantly lead them on to get votes. Every time the Clintons get a question about UFO disclosure, they never give a straight answer. My buddy Dan Down Under says, given that many sources have stated over the years that there are dozens of levels of security above the President of the United States, it seems very unlikely. Love to hear your thoughts. At Micah Hanks, you can tweet at me, info@MicahHanks.com, if you'd like to send along an email. Speaking of folks who've been sending along emails, we'll get to a few of those really quickly here. Christy writes, so we experienced an incredibly loud explosion-type sound unlike anything I've ever heard before that shook our house in Woodbury Heights, New Jersey on Saturday night, March 5th, 2016. This was around 10:50 p.m., possibly 10:51 precisely, based on a text I received from a neighbor. Wow, now that is good note-taking. Give her an A+. She says, I immediately walked around for smoke or flames and saw nothing. We heard no sirens. We called the police and the fire department. No one seems to have had any answers even days later. The entire town heard this. One of my neighbors posted about it on Facebook, and apparently her friend in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and her entire town heard the same type of unexplained boom around that exact same time over an hour away. Bizarre. Thanks for writing in with that mystery boom report, Christy. And I do recommend people, if you haven't been over there and checked it out yet, mysterybooms.com is the website. And I've got a lot of information on the possible scientific causes underlying reports of mystery booms. But on a case-for-case basis, there are a number of different things that could account for those noises as they are reported. NK writes, Ted Cruz is the Zodiac Killer? Aliens controlling the sun? What kind of bovine scatology is this? If I wanted to read the tabloid trash basket crap, I would subscribe to the National Enquirer. If this is the way it's going to be, then I'm going to bail out. This is a quick way to ruin your credibility. Now, in fairness, let me explain what NK is complaining about. We had carried a headline in the Grayling Daily News the other day that described the sociological phenomenon as it relates to people editing Wikipedia entries on potential candidates in this election year. And one of the running jokes has been that someone had been going in there on the Wikipedia entry for Ted Cruz and mentioning in the headline that he is, of course, a presidential hopeful, a Texas senator, and possibly the Zodiac Killer, which is, of course, impossible because he wouldn't be old enough to be that anyway. Now, that, to me, is an interesting headline, that there is a problem with Wikipedia entries being edited in this way. But we, of course, were not advocating seriously. And I am pretty sure that 99.999% with a line over the last nine, most of the listeners of this podcast and readers of the Daily News got that that's not the position that we actually take here at the Grayling Report. We don't know. No, I'm serious. We don't think that Ted Cruz is actually the Zodiac Killer. But that's okay, I know. From time to time, people get confused about these things. Keith writes, I keep hearing you say you're in a secret bunker. I looked on Google trying to find images of what it looks like, but I can't find any. I'm wondering if you can send me pics of what your station looks like. Thanks. Well, Keith, I'd love to, but, I mean, if I sent you pictures of our secret underground facility, it wouldn't be secret, would it? Right? Umar writes, Hi, Mike. A huge fan of the Grayling Report here in Toronto, Canada. Your podcast has been one of my favorites since I started listening weekly 2 years ago. Well, thank you, Umar. Your approach to the paranormal with a side of healthy skepticism is unique and greatly appreciated. I wanted to get in touch with you about a couple of things. Your latest edition of the Grayling Report briefly covered the phenomenon of waking up in the middle of the night and how it is the time of night one is most creative and active. Now, as I come from an Islamic background, upon hearing this, I was immediately able to make the connection between this and what we call the night prayer. This is actually a voluntary prayer that is regarded highly in the religion for the blessings that it brings simply as a reward of the struggle one puts into getting out of bed at such a time. I've included a Wikipedia link below with more information, which he did in his email. Now, I personally find prayer to have some sort of connection with meditation, so to hearken back to another listener email about the negative side effects of meditation, perhaps one should experiment meditating at this time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And I think that's a brilliant idea. And actually, honestly, Umar, I'll say that often when I'm laying awake at night and I cannot sleep, that is one of my favorite times to pray or meditate. And I'll engage in a bit of both. So I think that that's a very insightful observation about that that you make. Umar continues, secondly, I've been quite active on your colleague and friend Jim Harold's Virtual Campfire Facebook group. I come from a South Asian background, Pakistan to be exact, and moved to Canada 10 years ago, where the gin phenomenon is prevalent and widely accepted even by the scientific community there. After telling my own experience on Jim's Campfire podcast, I've been quite active on the Facebook group with posts. My posts have garnered a following of sorts, with many members expressing their fascination with the gin. Nick Redfern, John Keel, and Rosemary Ellen Guiley have all spoken about this, the possible connections between paranormal phenomena, such as shadow people, black-eyed children, the men in black, etc., and the djinn. But I thought I'd put in my two cents as well as someone who comes from the djinn land, for lack of a better word. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what I've brought to light so far. And he included some links, but again, if you head on to, or if you go over to Facebook and just check out the campfire, Jim Harold's Campfire on Facebook, you should be able to find Umar's post. You may enjoy engaging with him about some of those topics. And of course, you know, if you haven't checked out Jim Harold's Campfire, it's great because it's a whole podcast that's based around sourcing stories from listeners like you, just as we feature in the email segment on this program. So do check it out. Once again, Umar concludes, I'm a big Graylian Report listener and fan. Really glad you guys brought the Paranormal Report back. Thanks and keep up the great work, Sir Umar. That beautiful letter, by the way. Thank you, Umar, for writing and sharing that insightful information. And he's right. Jim Harold and I, just this past Tuesday, did a brand new edition of the Paranormal Report. And the way we're doing it now is we actually broadcast it live every other Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. We take live calls from people around the world during the second hour. We had callers from the Netherlands, I think from South America. We had callers from England. We had callers literally from all over the world the other night. It was a great time. And those podcasts, after the fact, are put up on iTunes as well, so you can check those out. Or just head over to graylianreport.com, and you'll find the podcasts there just as well. Aaron writes, Mike, I recently listened to the Graylian Report episode on the Phoenix Lights from last week. I wanted to share something that happened to me in October of 1998. I was driving at about 1 a.m. in the area of Liberty, South Carolina. I've been there, by the way, many times. The boys and I, when we're out on the road in the summertime, we frequent parts of South Carolina, and we've often driven right through that area. So Aaron says, at the time, I was about 10 miles from the nearest town, so light pollution was fairly low. As I came around a bend in the road, my headlights malfunctioned, causing me to stop the car. The car had some electrical problems. I don't attribute that to what happened next. As I opened the door to get out of the car, I looked up, and at around a 45-degree angle to my line of sight was a black triangular object. It was to the right of the road and moving slowly to my left. It appeared to me to be about the size of a large commercial airplane and had three dim red lights near each corner. The illumination of these lights were just enough that I could make out the shape. I watched for about 1 to 2 minutes as it moved over the road, and then it began to accelerate and moved out of view. Now, at the time, I was 17 years old, and I thought I'd witnessed something extraterrestrial. I was terrified, and I didn't tell anybody about it for months. As I've grown older, I've come to think that this may indeed have been very terrestrial in origin. I find reports of the mystery blimps that you talk about fascinating, and wonder if this was something similar. Thanks for all you do, and keep up the good work, Aaron. Well, thank you, Aaron, for being, again, brave enough to ride in with what you've seen. Because I understand people who have that kind of an experience, when you see something that seems so foreign, so seemingly exotic, and as is the case with these large flying triangles, something that is so large, which is one reason I think that there's some variety of a stealth blimp or something along those lines, naturally it's going to be disturbing for people. And that is understandable, and there's nothing to be ashamed of in stating, hey, I saw something, it was really creepy looking, it scared me. Because I think we've all been there. We've all experienced that. There was a note that Doug Skinner put up. Doug Skinner being an artist and a Fortean researcher based in New York. Great guy. I'd love to get him on this show sometime. I'd love to talk with Doug. But Doug, he kind of inherited all of John Keel, the late John Keel's files when he passed away. And he put them up. I think johnkeel.net, I think, is the webpage. I'll have to look into that. If it's not .net, it's .com, and it's a fairly simple-looking blog that just features uploads in PDF form of a lot of Keel's writings and papers from over the years. And again, for those who aren't familiar with who John Keel was, he was the author of the book The Mothman Prophecies. He had written a lot of fabulous books, though. One of the best UFO books you'll probably ever read from that era was called Operation Trojan Horse. Wrote a lot of books over the years. And John came into this as a writer back in the 1950s. He traveled throughout the Orient, and he decided he would try to get to the bottom of what was known as jadu throughout parts of the Oriental world. In other words, black magic, and whether or not there was some basis in reality to the beliefs in black magic. And so he traveled throughout, you know, all different parts of, oh gosh, Egypt, and all the way up into Tibet and in India. And in that book, he catalogs a lot of interesting things, including having met with... With people who had claimed that they had seen the Yeti, the alleged, abominable snowman of the Himalayas, or Himalayas, as Keel described it or pronounced it. Maybe the grammar police can check my pronunciation there, but anyway. The kind of scope of what John Keel did was he didn't look at these things as just being, you know, little green men from outer space. He was one of the earliest people to say, whatever UFOs are, they may not be extraterrestrial alien visitors. There may be something completely different going on here. Which I think attracted the attention of other like-minded researchers, the likes of Jacques Vallée, namely, and others over the years. And he was widely criticized and ridiculed, as many were, for being bold enough to say, look, you know, I don't know that we have enough evidence before us that suggests that UFOs unequivocally, without question, are extraterrestrial aliens from another world. And so, naturally, although I think he got a little far out there with some of his other ideas, I naturally liked a lot of John Keel's writings. And a lot of people who don't know this, you know, if you've ever read Fate magazine over the last couple of years, you know, I've been writing a column in Fate called Beyond the Known Part 2. And the reason it's called that is because John Keel had written for years a column in Fate magazine called Beyond the Known. And when Phyllis Galdi approached me about writing a column, she asked if I would actually pick up under the name of the column that John Keel had once written, which was an incredible honor. Although my ideas and opinions are quite different from Keel's, again, you can respect somebody whether or not you agree with them on all points. Typically, American politics comes down to that, too. You'll very seldom find a candidate with whom you share complete 100% ideological similarity. You know, it's usually a case of picking, right, the lesser evil. Or if Cthulhu were running for office, we could say, why pick the lesser evil? Pick the evilest of all. Yeah? Cthulhu Fagan, or whatever. It's meant to be unpronounceable, but I digress. So, the point is that, you know, when it comes to John Keel and some of these guys are known as being intrepid researchers. They get out there in the field. You know, they're really, you know, as we know with Keel and what he wrote about in his books like Mothman Prophecies, whether or not you believe in there being a physical creature called the Mothman, and even Keel came off of that a bit in his later years, there are moments where if you read through his old journal entries that Doug Skinner has posted there at the John Keel website, and one in particular that comes to mind where he was sitting in a car and it was like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And he sees a purple, kind of an amorphous light pass overhead that he said was vaguely saucer-esque in shape. And it descends into this little ravine, and he wants to go down into this ravine, but he writes, he's all by himself out there, 1 o'clock in the morning, scribbling on his little notepad, and he says, damn, I'm scared. And it's natural when you're confronted with what appears to be very unnatural at times to feel a certain sense of fear or concern or apprehension or anxiety. I mean, that is natural. And that's what's most difficult about this kind of research. And again, you know, even from a more skeptical disposition on things, as I tend to be, I maintain that I think that there are enough people in this world who are, and who have allowed themselves to become hardened in their skepticism to the point that they will not even allow for the possible existence of the unexplained. Because, frankly, I think on a deep, deeply psychological kind of level, I think that they are so moved and perhaps disturbed by the possibility of what if, and that is so reality shattering for them, or would be if they chose to accept it, that I think that sometimes, whether or not it's a conscious decision, a choice has been made nonetheless by some individuals as it relates to whether or not they choose to believe in something. And that, I think, is certainly problematic, because I don't think a lot of people realize how they're, again, sometimes it's not even skepticism. Sometimes I think it could be their discomfort with the discussion of certain alleged unexplained phenomena may actually be what informs their skepticism. Just a theory. It's just a hunch, but, you know, almost said just a thunch, you know. Can it be a theory and a hunch? Yes. We call this a thunch. Graylian Report, creating words day by day. So, looking at a little bit more of the news before we get to the break here. Apparently, it's been reported that there's a 66-million-year-old giant asteroid that smashed into Earth. Of course, this being the very same which killed off all the dinosaurs, along with most other earthly life at that time. And, of course, we've talked about this in the past. This catastrophic event occurred at what is now known as the Chicxulub crater a spot where this asteroid struck so many millions of years ago. It's located in the Yucatan Peninsula off the coast of Mexico. Scientists apparently always wanted to know what exactly happened after that asteroid hit the Earth and how life bounced back after the mass extinction and whether the crater itself spawned novel microbial life at that time. Well, researchers are now planning to drill into the impact crater to see if they can find certain answers. Now, according to Sean Gulick from the University of Texas, he says the Chicxulub is the only preserved structure with an intact peak ring that we can get to. Okay, he says all the other ones are either or actually on other planets, or they've been eroded. Now, the team of researchers that Gulick is working with, geophysicists and the like, hope to start drilling in April. They're going to try and dig down to as much as 1,500 meters to extract core samples lying deep in the crater. Then they're going to look for changes in rock types and other fossils to try and work out the devastating impact. The Chicxulub crater was discovered in the late 1970s. It measured more than 180 kilometers in diameter and 20 kilometers in depth, making it the third largest confirmed impact crater. Scientists are aiming to analyze different layers of Earth inside the impact area. Just above the crater lies a 100-meter or more thick layer where scientists are expecting to find chunks of bedrock blasted up by the impact. Above that would be sediments and hardened deposits, deposits of ash just as well. Now, the crater down to 800 meters is expected to have fewer species of shell-producing animals that make up the limestone because life was recovering from the impact. Researchers are also most interested in peak rings. The peak rings are found in large numbers on the moon and planets like Mars and Mercury, but on Earth they are very rare. In fact, there are only three peak rings known, including the one in question that we discuss here. The peak ring may have also hosted the life. The peak ring is fractured in some places, and these fractures were filled with hot fluids after the impact and could be preferred spots for microbes to grow. Gulick told CNN this week, he said, "We have some hypothesis as to what we will find. We expect to see a period of no life initially and then life returning and getting more diverse throughout time." Again, I guess we could always return to that famous quote from Dr. Ian Malcolm of Jurassic Park fame, "Life finds a way." And it really always does seem to, doesn't it? You know, one of the cases, speaking of life rebounding, and we'll come back around to a little more discussion of strange life forms here in just a moment, but or maybe strange life forms that once existed, which are yet to reappear with the help of modern science. That's always, speaking of Jurassic Park, a rather interesting discussion. But when it comes to marine mysteries and you know, animal life and the like, this doesn't really have to do with what killed off the dinosaurs. But I will say this. In the time of the dinosaurs, obviously, there were strange creatures on planet, at least strange by today's standards. You look at the dinosaurs. Sometimes, you know, you'll have that moment when you walk through a museum, like I did, actually, in South Carolina with Jason Pentrail, who will be with us here in just a few minutes, in fact. And you walk through and you look at fossils of extinct animal species. You sometimes will find yourself saying, my God, it is hard to believe that the creatures that look like this might have existed on this planet, that they may have been right here. And one case that I might bring up with Jason a little bit in the next hour involved, I think it was 1905, and it was the Meadwaldo and Nichols observation of an alleged sea serpent. This occurred off the coast of Brazil. These two naturalists, fellows of the British Natural History Museum, if memory serves, they were out there on the sailing vessel. It was actually a scientific research vessel called the Valhalla. And they saw at first what they described as a strange brownish fin appear. And as Meadwaldo, one of the two researchers, yes, he had two last names apparently with a hyphen between, he lifts his spotting scope and he's looking at the fin, and then a large neck appears with a small head on the top. It was, again, brownish in color from the chin and the under portion of the neck all the way down to where it went back under the water. It was white, but it was brown on top, white on the bottom. The neck, he said, was roughly about the thickness of a slender man, and that the head on top was, you know, roughly that of a tortoise or a turtle, very much like a turtle in appearance. And these two men were able to observe this thing as it swam along for a number of minutes. They said it had a strange back-and-forth motion as it traveled through the water. Maybe I won't say too much because it'd be much more appropriate to bring this up in the next hour when we're talking with Jason. But, you know, again, stories like this really fascinate me. And I wonder sometimes, in addition to, well, how does life, you know, what is the ebb and flow of life and these catastrophic events that can destroy life, and yet it always comes back. And sometimes when it comes back, it's completely different from what had once existed. especially when we talk about what, you know, the impact event that that led to the destruction of Earth as we know it in the day of the dinosaurs. Could there be creatures out there in the oceans that exist still? Creatures that might resemble the kinds of things that once inhabited the ocean waters so many millions of years ago. I don't know if it's impossible. I really don't. And there are many people who say that maybe there's something more to it. Again, these two very trained naturalists saying, look, we saw this thing go through a spotting scope. We observed it, for a considerable amount of time. Whatever it was, it had some sort of a fin on its back and a long neck. We could only presume that what we saw off the coast of Brazil, some 13, 14 miles off the coast, by the way, that what we observed that day was the famous, the legendary sea serpent that so many speak of. We'll talk about that a little more in the next hour, but here's one I'll leave you with before we go to break. You know, we talk about these ancient species, whether certain ones could exist today and may have held over since ancient times. But maybe you've heard about this discovery of a pair of 12,000-year-old Stone Age cave lion cubs. I was looking at photographs that appeared in the Daily Mail. John James from Cumbria, our friend who contributes to the Daily News, sent this story along, and he specifically said it'd be great to hear this one on the show this week. So John, goes out to you, pal. And I'm fascinated with this. If you haven't gone over, this is linked in the Daily News today, the date, of course, being March the 7th, Monday the 7th. So check this out because the photos are incredible. These little cave lion cubs are remarkably well preserved. I mean, some of the best that I've ever seen to have existed 12,000 years ago. And as reported by the Daily Mail, the scientists who have discovered these guys are now trying to hope to clone these extinct cave lions because these little fellows are so perfectly preserved. The South Korean team seeking to reanimate the pair, found around 650 miles from the local capital at Yakutsk, is already trying to bring back the long-extinct woolly mammoth as well. Experts have said that these perfectly preserved predators, which they've named Uyan and Dina, are a sensational find. Now, the controversial cloning expert Hwang Woo-suk visited Yatsuk this weekend to watch over scientists as they remove samples of skin and muscle tissue from a young cave lion. He was embroiled in a bizarre dispute with a Siberian scientist over the size of the samples that he could take to experiment on. Hwang was unhappy with the samples that he retrieved. According to Semyon Grigory, it's Grigoryev, the director of the world-famous Mammoth Museum in Yaksuk. He told the Siberian Times they expected to take more, and they did with the woolly mammoth previously. But then again, I mean, that's a much larger specimen than these little cave lions. He says, but it will not work with these little kittens. You have to understand the lion cub is very small, so it would not be possible to get as much as we would like. One of the cubs is being kept in a Russian freezer indefinitely to await scientific advances in cloning. That makes more sense, right? Rather than screwing it all up and trying to do it with what we've got today, wait until we're really good at it and then bring one of these little guys back. But then again, we're talking about, again, an ice age predator, right? They look really cute, but what happens when he gets bigger? It's kind of like when you own a pet alligator, right? Oh, he's adorable when he fits in a fishbowl, but then when you got to, you know, transfer him over to a bathtub, things start getting a little bit out of hand. Oh, yeah, and then what happens when the guy's big enough to, well, go live in the swimming pool out back? What do? You just let him loose into the sewers? Maybe there's something to some of these urban legends that we hear from time to time about alligators in the city sewers after all. Adam Olson, I know that you would probably chime in on that. Who knows? Again, I always get a little wary when it comes to the cloning, but it seems to be an inevitability. In the coming years, we're going to be facing previously extinct animal species. Those which once existed and which, of course, thanks to the resurrective technologies of tomorrow, are yet to exist once again. We'll pick up this discussion with Jason Pentrell as we delve into discussion of the Megalodon and other sea monsters. On the other side of this break, it is the Graylian Report. Stay with us.
Live alternative.
Live.
In over 100.
Here we go. In 5, 4. Three, two, one.
We'll be right back.
unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Mike Hanks.
And welcome back. It is the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Glad, as always, to be keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via the wonders of the KGRA Radio Network. .com. That's right. Yeah, it's going to be good stuff tonight as we get Jason Pentrell here into the conversation with us. Do deep sea monsters exist? If they didn't, or rather I should say, if they don't still exist, they certainly did at one time. We'll talk about that and probably a host of other things just as well. Going to be good times indeed. But first, I do want to remind you, if you'd like to dig in a little bit, or maybe I should say, as the sharks would say, take a bite out of what we do. I don't know if that made as much sense, but then again, those, you know, human-eating hadals down here in the Hollow Earth would know what I'm talking about. That's right, you can make your way on down to the bunker, become a subscriber, GrailianReport.com/X. You can sign up, get additional weekly shows like the special Sherlock Holmes show that we did this past weekend, and of course also the Grailian Enigmas. Those have become the most popular subscriber shows without question. People love Grailian Enigmas. Grailian Enigmas is a show that takes a slightly more theatrical approach to famous classic cases, kind of in the same vein of In Search Of or Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, those kinds of television programs you grew up on and that you loved. And many of us, I think, who are interested in this sort of subject probably kind of cut our teeth watching programs like that. I used to love hearing Leonard Nimoy, you know, as he would narrate those classic shows, classic investigations. And actually, there were a lot of really good points that were made on those programs. I don't think that today we see quite that same level of quality on programming that we see on television like we once did. But boy, I tell you know, with Grailian Enigmas, we strive to try and get a similar vibe, an eerie vibe, but also one that's an informational kind of a presentation of these classic stories. So when I went down to Charleston, South Carolina back in January, talk about stories. The guy that we're about to talk to here in a moment, he can tell you a few. He is quite a scholar, quite a researcher, in fact, and as I often do when I travel to different parts of the country and world, for that matter, there are a lot of people, you know, that people who are out there listening right now and people who are interacting with us on Twitter. Dan James, there, who's tweeting at me right now. I mean, you know, he and I had breakfast together out at, in Big Bear Lake, California, and Paul McBay, actually, who's tweeted at me there. I believe he's down in Charleston, in the same general area where Jason is, just as well. And that's one of the great things about doing this, is that there are people all over the world who listen to the show. They have information that they like to share, and they like to contribute their knowledge. And so Jason had reached out to me and said, look, you know, if you're ever down here in Charleston, would love to show you around. And, you know, you figure somebody's going to take you to their favorite watering hole. You might have a beverage or something. No, we end up going to a museum. I'm shown incredible stages in the evolutionary history of deep sea mammals. You know, we discuss, of course, that most famous of the mega sharks, the Megalodon, and all kinds of other things. So without, you know, it goes without saying, this guy is very knowledgeable as a fossil shark researcher. Jason's also fascinated with cultural studies. He actually has his master's degree in environmental management and policy, and he's, again, quite the interesting Fortean just as well. So I told him, as we're sitting there together at Tommy Condon's pub, I said, we've got to get you on the Grailian Report. Without further ado, here he is, Jason Pentrell. Welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thanks so much, Micah. It's a real honor to be here, and I think we're going to have a great time tonight.
I think so, too. Yeah, and I was just telling Race during the break, you know, we're sitting there together having a Guinness, and Jason is talking about his interest in the Megalodon and how right there off the coast of South Carolina it had been, you know, kind of a hub, an aquatic hub for these legendary mega sharks. And he pulls out of his pocket an actual fossil Megalodon tooth, which I have right here in the bunker with me on the little shrine behind my studio console. The perfect addition, I think, to any Fortean researcher's collection. And I had to ask him, and as I'll ask you now for our listeners, you know, how did you get into studying Megalodon and these paleontological wonders of the ancient world?
Well, Mike, you know, looking back here, there's a really rich and valued history in Charleston, South Carolina. Most people only see the historical side of it, you know, from modern times. But it was a few years ago, I have a good friend here in the local area who's a diver. And he had been diving down in the rivers, and one day I went to his house, and he opened up this big glass case, and he said, come here, I want to show you my Megalodon tooth collection. And of course, I'm, you know, familiar with sharks, but I'd never seen anything quite that impressive before. So I think you can attest to this. Once you hold one of these fossils in your hand, it really takes over the imagination, and it puts you in a new state of mind and a new appreciation for not only geologic time, but for the animals and the creatures that have lived in the past. And that was it. Once I held that fossil tooth in my hand and ran my thumb over the serrations of that blade, felt the weight, my imagination was running wild. I was completely hooked. And from then on, it was nothing but research, nothing but reading every report, anything I could find on the topic and the subject. And then going from there, I learned that throughout the entire southeast, there's quite a large collection of Megalodon fossils, along with many other prehistoric treasures that wash out in creeks. And even in my very own neighborhood here, in right outside of Charleston, you can go in any creek after a good rain, and you're likely to find some fossils washing out right in the middle of a neighborhood from the old ancient formations. So once I began down that road, there was really no turning back. Once you hold that tooth in your hand, you're pretty much hooked.
I mean, yeah, hooked in the most literal sense. And, of course, we're talking about monstrous aquatic life of the ancient world. Am I correct in saying that, again, one of the primary feeding areas for the Megalodon, the famous, mega shark from prehistoric times, I mean, was right there off the coast of Charleston?
Yeah, that's absolute fact. And what's more fascinating is the time period during which the Megalodon was the king of the seas, if you will, was known as the Miocene, or the epoch of the Miocene. And at that particular time in history, the entire lower portion of South Carolina, from about Columbia, South Carolina, which is the capital, pretty much dead in the middle of the state, down, was actually underwater. Florida, for the most part, almost 100% underwater, and large portions of Georgia, large portions of North Carolina and Virginia were all part of a shallow sea at that particular time. During that time, there was huge migrations of whales. Whales were quite abundant at that time. There was also dugongs, which is a distant relative of the modern-day manatee, or the sea cow, how some people call them down in Florida. So this made a perfect breeding ground for the Megalodon. It was a shallow sea. It was teeming with life. And they would come here to give birth to their young, which I might add were 8 to 10 feet when they were born.
Wow.
If you want to put that in perspective, most great white sharks today are about 15 to 20 feet at max. So these things were coming out, and they were already at that particular size, ready to feed. So they were feeding on the whales, they were feeding on the dugongs, and they were feeding on the abundant life here in the shallow sea of South Carolina, which explains why you can find them inland. I'm 25 miles inland from the coast, and I find them right here in my neighborhood. And it goes all the way up many more miles past where I live to where the old ancient sea finally ended.
Yeah, and folks, he is not kidding. Again, when you hold one of these teeth in your hand, again, roughly, I'm 5'11", and I can hold one of these things, and it roughly fills the palm of my hand, okay? So this is a creature that easily, and I think that the specimen that was that you showed me in the museum, the private collection that we observed when I was down there visiting in Charleston, I would easily, in fact, three of me would easily fit right through the open mouth of one of these creatures, and that wasn't even as large as they could get. I mean, how big, again, when we're talking about full-grown, how big did the Megalodon sharks actually get?
Well, there's a few things to consider there. One, there's some bad information and what I would call some extravagant sizes that have been put out there over the years, but we can safely say that maximum size on these creatures would have been about 65 feet.
Whoa!
So, essentially, picture about a city bus and a half with jaws that would open 6.5 to 7 feet wide. And the biggest tooth that I've ever seen, which is, if not the world record, pretty close to the world record, was 7.24 inches. Now, keep in mind the one that you have that fills your hand is about a 3.5-inch Megalodon tooth. So that was, pretty much a, not a baby, but it was certainly not a full-grown shark by any means. The largest one I have in my personal collection is 6.5 inches and weighs well over a pound.
Wow.
Oh. So basically, you look at a modern-day great white shark, and a great white shark that we see today would have by comparison, been nowhere even close. I mean, not even in the same ballpark with the megalodon. There was a really interesting study done a few years ago where they were trying to determine the bite force of something that strong. So they looked at, you know, the jaws and the way that they feed, along with the type of prey that they would have been eating. And mind you, they ate whales for the most part. So that gives you a pretty good insight to the size of these creatures and their feeding habits.
Yeah.
But the bite force was registered at, you know, this is, of course, an approximation, at 182,000 newtons, which comes out to about 41,000 pounds of bite force. You compare that to something like a Tyrannosaurus rex, which is at 57,000 newtons. That comes out to about 13,000 pounds of bite force.
Wow.
So I can honestly say, I can safely say with good confidence that the megalodon was by far, in my opinion, the apex predator of all time.
Wow.
There is no comparison. It takes the cake, you know, all day long against anything else that we've ever known.
That is so fascinating. Again, most people, I mean, yeah, a giant shark would be pretty scary. But, you know, when you compare it, you know, against, you know, or alongside a dragon-esque creature like the Tyrannosaurus, you know, or the other dinosaurs, again, you know, these land predators. Yeah, these things seem more, I guess, possibly due to the fact that they're so exotic, they might seem more frightening. But again, I don't think that there's anything more frightening than a 72-foot shark that's got, you know, the ability to probably bite a city bus in half. I mean, that's getting on out there. This is literally a very, without question, very much a sea monster of the ancient world.
Well, I mean, you nailed it right there. It is exactly that. If there's ever anything that captures the imagination, this has got to be it. You know, often I think back to, you know, earlier times in our human evolution, and, you know, there's primal fears that are built into us as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say those primal fears are usually related to paws, claws, and jaws. And I'll throw fangs in there for good measure, too. Nobody likes fangs. But when you go back to these primal fears and these early things that got our attention and put us, you know, on the defense, there is nothing more frightening than, you know, you got to use your imagination here. Now, you can hold that megalodon tooth that I gave you in your hand, and you can really think back. You got to think about, okay, you know, I'm in the ocean, you know, I can't see anything. And if you've ever seen a great white shark breach on like a Discovery Channel show or something like that, so basically come out of the water to hit its prey,
mm-hmm.
It's widely believed, and not proven, but it's often believed that megalodon may have done that with the whales, as you know, along the same type of feeding pattern, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to imagine a whale swimming across the surface of the water, and then a 60-foot animal coming up from underneath it and removing the entire tail or removing an entire fin of the animal, and then being able to polish it off. Now they guess that there would be about 2,500 pounds of meat per day that would have to be eaten for these sharks to maintain their body weight, maintain their metabolism, and all these type of things. So you're looking at a time period where, you know, there would have been massive amounts of carnage in the seas, if you will. And, you know, at that time, megalodon was just one of many massive species. I mean, we're just talking about one shark here. There were many, many, many others, possibly hundreds of sharks that were just as big, just as strong. Well, half as big, half as strong. Let's go with that.
Sure.
Megalodon was definitely the biggest of the big. But, you know, at 65 tons, which is what it's estimated to have weighed, you can imagine, you know, it fully encapsulates the imagination. And if there's anything that we as humans would be most afraid of, it would have to be this creature, because there's no comparison to it on anything that I've ever seen. Unless there's a new fossil that pops up here soon that no one's ever seen before, it definitely takes the cake.
Yeah, to say the least. You know, I got to ask you, there was this documentary. Actually, I prefer to say mockumentary. About the megalodon. It garnered a lot of attention, and I would say that maybe that the best thing about this is that it does bring attention to this ancient deep sea, in proper context, I don't think megalodon was really a deep sea predator, right? This was more like a coastal waters an inland feeder.
Yeah, coastal.
Well, you know, but the mockumentary in question, which I think Discovery Network aired, you know, posited the What, again, many looked at as they watched this, not knowing that this wasn't an actual documentary, a seemingly plausible scenario that these creatures might still exist. Now, I would presume that if indeed they did, we would still be finding probably hefts of whales drifting about in there, out there in the ocean, if something so large were out there, because it would have to sustain itself in likelihood. Do you think that there's any realistic potential that a creature like Megalodon could still exist?
Well, I mean, while it's often the way for people to want to use their imagination and hope for the best, there is no evidence at this time that Megalodon is still around. As I said, we're talking about a 65-foot shark, 65 tons, 6 to 7 inch teeth fully grown, and you have to have a breeding stock of these animals out there swimming around in order to maintain the population. Now, as we said, here in South Carolina and Florida and all these areas, they were in that shallow sea where they would come to give birth. Of course, the bigger sharks would then move further off sea into slightly deeper water, but they are by nature not a deep water species as far as we can tell. Now, granted, there have been some fossils recovered from deep areas of the ocean off of New Caledonia and some other areas throughout the world, but those were probably just deposited as this, that the sharks were swimming over the top. So, you know, if they're feeding on whales, they're needing 2,500 pounds of food a day to maintain. There would be evidence constantly. You would see whales washing up all the time with massive gaping wounds. You know, there would be the migration. You know, these are highly migratory species we're talking about here. Sharks are all generally a highly migratory species, so they're going to travel, you know, great distances to find their food source, but they are going to stay generally close to the coast, because that's where the majority of the food sources are at. So you can't hide something like this. Now, I would love to be wrong. Mm-hmm. When people say, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? You would love for there to be a megalodon? Well, of course, you know, I would love to see one, because there's always that question of what did it look like? Did it have spots? Did it have stripes? You know, was it black? Was it white? Did it look like a big great white? You know, what is this beast of the sea look like? And unfortunately, we can't know that. The only things that fossilize on a megalodon are the vertebrae of the spine and the teeth themselves. Sharks have cartilaginous skeletons, so that's the only parts of the shark that are going to fossilize. So it leads back to all it left for us was the business end of the shark, which is the rest of it we kind of have to reconstruct with our imaginations. But, you know, over the years, those fossil teeth that have been left behind are remarkable. And, you know, if you're not familiar with how a fossil occurs, the short of it is the tooth will come out of the mouth millions of years ago, and it'll settle down in some sediments at the bottom of the ocean, at which time it'll be covered over by sand or by silt. And once it gets in the right position and gets buried, it will then take on the mineral composition of whatever it's buried in, which like your tooth is black, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So it's picking up phosphorus, breakdown of phosphorus material, which is causing it to have that color.
And I want to point out, by the way, for those at home, he's talking about the shark tooth he gave me, not my actual teeth. They are not black. Sorry, go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, although shark teeth could be pretty interesting for some parties or get-togethers. it takes on the color of whatever mineral that it's in, basically. So people often ask me, well, I've seen shark teeth before and they're white, so how come these fossils are black or gray or tan or yellow? And that's why. But getting back to what I was talking about previously, these have been found for years and years and years, and it's really interesting how humans began to first try to understand, what is it that I'm looking at? You know, what is this thing that I'm holding in my hand?
Sure.
And it goes back to, even back to a remarkable character who I think's a great read if you've never heard of him. It's Pliny the Elder from 70 AD. He was a Roman author and naturalist. He actually died in the eruption of Vesuvius, not Vesuvius, but
yeah.
He was known for his encyclopedias that he would write. And back during that time, he would find these, you know, various shark teeth, fossilized shark teeth, and in rock up on the shore, because now the ocean has receded back to the sea and left behind these fossils. Well, it makes you kind of laugh and look at the wonderment of the human mind, because he's trying to figure out what are these things and where did they come from. So somehow he came to the conclusion that they were triangular objects that meteors rained from the sky, but only during lunar eclipses. another great story about the fossilized shark teeth comes from the Middle Ages, where people actually believed that the shark teeth were the tongues of serpents or snakes, or even dragons, that were turned to stone by St. Paul, of all people. The story goes that St. Paul was shipwrecked on Malta. At that time, he was bitten by a snake, and so he shook the snake loose, and he cast all of the snakes off the island, and he turned their forked tongues into stone, so they say. So the triangular objects became, throughout the Middle Ages, known as tongue stones or dragon tongues.
That's so funny. I was going to say, I mean, did anybody look at them, Jason, and say, oh, these could be dragon, oh, I don't know, teeth?
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. You know, they're, you know, in one guy's view, they're like, these are, you know, meteoric pieces of rock that are raining from the sky. And someone else is like, no, it's the, you know, it's the stone frozen tongue of a snake or a serpent or a dragon. But something else that's really interesting is the fact that the Native Americans would actually use the teeth. They would use them for tools. They would use them for ceremonial decoration. They would use them for all kinds of different purposes. In fact, there's been many artifacts found, especially down in Florida, of large megalodon teeth that have been drilled out and used for necklaces and gorgets and all kinds of different decorative ornaments. Maybe from a chief of the tribe or a high elder, but has a status symbol. And there's even been basically what you would call a manufacturing site found down in Florida, where there's been literally hundreds of drilled teeth found, showing that they were basically making them there like a factory and using them for trade with other tribes in the general area.
You know, that's fascinating in its own right. And I know that with, you know, your studies of, you know, Native American traditions and cultural traditions around the world, being another interest of yours, I mean, one can only think, Jason, that they would find these things. I mean, presumably some people in the ancient world would think of, you know, think of these as being anything from tongues to, you know, God knows what. But obviously some would think teeth just as well. And imagine the way that this would fuel the imaginations of the people who held these things, looked at them and thought, my gosh, you know, there must be or must have been at very least, you know, creatures that we couldn't fathom. You know, the things that extend beyond the imagination. Do you think that some of our legends, some of our folklore about here be dragons and the like, do you think that it could very well be that, you know, people's discovery of the fossil teeth of Megalodon and other extinct species had been the impetus or the origin point for a lot of these legends of dragons and monsters?
Oh, by far. I mean, you know, it goes back to the fossil record. I mean, as we have storms, as we have floods, as we have various weather trends over the ages, you know, it washes out these things. And I can only imagine, you know, these being perfect fuel for any amount of legend or even conjecture. And it's fun to look back and see what the ancient people thought, you know, to kind of get an idea of how did they interpret this and how did they decide to use it. You know, those same teeth that in the Middle Ages that were being found, it had many other beliefs that went along with them. The teeth had medicinal properties. They would often be cast in silver, gold. Many times they would be used because at the time, like I said, they thought that they were snake tongues, so they would use them to rub on wounds that they thought might become infected or might be poisonous. They would also use them to dip in a poisonous drink if they thought for a moment that their drink may be poisoned. And various different things. They would grind some of them up into powders and different things, and they thought them to be remedies for the plague, fevers, even things like epilepsy and bad breath, of all things.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's certainly interesting to see how they interpreted what they were looking at and basically made it a part of their daily life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and speaking of how all of this kind of fits into the daily life, you know, in the next segment, I want to kind of, you know, talk about how this has maybe inspired your own interest in the kinds of things that we discuss on programs like this, Fortiana and the like. When we come back from the break, I also want to mention, you know, this discussion of megalodons is already becoming troubling for people. The lovely Lady Claire there in Ireland has said that, unfortunately, she's going to have to cross surfing off of her list of things that she does, I guess, in the warmer weather months. That's okay. As far as we understand, the megalodon no longer exists, but hey, you know, imagination does. I don't know. I get out there in the deep water I don't think it'd have to be a megalodon for it to really be dangerous. Indeed, we hear about all these shark attacks. Who knows? But I do also want to ask Jason Pentrail, when we come back, could there be other things out there in the ocean? Maybe not megalodon, but could there be other creatures like what I was discussing in the last hour? Some of these sea serpents and creatures of the deep which appear in folklore and mythologies from around the world. We'll talk with Jason Pentrail about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Stay with us. From the heart of the Hollow Earth, I'm Micah Hanks, your light in the darkness. It is the Graylian Report, where we bring you news from beyond the fringe every week. Hey, for our shout-outs that we're sending tonight, to my buddy, the gal from Wales, Kim. Send a little cosmic love your way. You know, we talk about that from time to time here on the program. Imagine a world where we could all gather together, despite our differences, share information, exchange knowledge, get along, share conversation, have tea. For goodness sake. Or coffee and cake aboard a TARDIS. It would work out so well. That's cosmic love, babies. Indeed. Sending a little to all you guys out there in the listening audience as we continue our discussion of deep sea mysteries and, of course, those monsters of the deep that our guest tonight, Mr. Jason Pentrail, is such an expert on. And I have to say, it is truly fabulous to be able to have you on the show and talk to you about this stuff. I knew when I met Jason for the first time down in Charleston. And he had me at Megalodon, but I knew from that first day, you know, stomping around Charleston, going to the museum and looking at the dinosaur fossils, the ancient, you know, shark's teeth, you know, the cave sloths, and of course, you know, the various evolutionary stages evidenced throughout ancient history of whale species and other different kinds of life forms on planet Earth, armadillos, trilobites. I mean, truly, this is a remarkable planet on which we live, and as yet, in terms of our confirmation of the existence of life, the only known planet that has life in the universe. There may be others. I'm convinced there probably are. I don't know. Where do you stand on that, Jason? I mean, I know that that's not exactly the scope of what we're discussing here, but when it comes to alien life, do you think there's weird stuff out there? And could it be any weirder than the plethora of different things we've seen here on Earth over the eons?
Well, you know, I'll start by saying hopefully there's no space megalodons. That could lead to some interesting research. But you know, that's the age old question. You know, we look so much for confirmation of are we the only things out here floating around in this great abyss of time and space. But you know, I'm hopeful. I'm as hopeful for life on other planets and other galaxies as I am for, you know, discovering cryptids and lost animals and species that are here on our own planet that we have yet to discover. You know, while the ocean is deep, and what we're talking about here tonight with the megalodon mostly revolves around, you know, a coastal species. There's still so much to explore in our own seas. There's so much to explore on our own planet. But, you know, there's a part of me that feels like we're just a small part of something bigger out there in the cosmos. And I would hate to think that this was it, that we were the only, you know, type of life out there. But, you know, I certainly do not believe that we're the only things out there. And as time goes on, you know, as technology advances, probably or may not be in my lifetime, but, you know, hopefully someone down the road will be able to confirm that for us to some degree at least.
Yeah, one would hope. And I'm with you. You know, it's interesting that people place so much emphasis on, you know, travel to other planets, the discovery of alien life. Now, again, and it's in no way intended, that statement. to you know, take away from the importance of the eventual discovery of life elsewhere in the universe, because the difference between studying the Earth's oceans and you know, the determination that we are not alone in the universe is, well, that we know that there's life on Earth. There may yet be new life forms to be found, as there most certainly will be, but to know that we are not the only planet that is habitable, and that we are not the only you know, planet that has life, that's going to be a real game changer. But as that you know, be that as it may, again, when we delve into the science of deep ocean life, and you know, and this is something I wanted to ask you about just as well, as it relates to extremely large animal species. A creature like Megalodon may not exist today, but you know, there is such a thing as, and look it up if you've never heard of this before, folks at home, deep sea gigantism. You know, the preponderance of larger species that exist closer to the ocean's floor. You know, what are your thoughts about that as it relates to claims of sea monsters? Because I do want to kind of get your opinion, Jason. I know from talking with you, you know, you're interested in Fortiana. You listen to a lot of the great Fortean podcasts, you know, Kem and Kyle, Expanded Perspectives, Shannon LeGros, you know, a lot of the great podcasters in our community who address these subjects, and cryptozoology is certainly something that comes up quite often. You and I've discussed it in depth too. So I'm interested in, you know, while we've looked at kind of the real world practical aspect of sea monsters, what has existed, how certain, you know, discoveries may have also influenced folk belief, as far as the actual existence of real world creatures as yet unknown, some monstrous in their capacities and existent in the world today, could there be creatures like that? Could there be deep sea monsters, the likes of which we could only imagine, but are yet to be found and may actually exist?
Well, I mean, the bottom of the ocean is a long ways down. And generally it's thought that the bottom of the ocean is much like a desert. We consider, you know, our coral reefs to be ecological habitats, are almost home bases, if you will, for most species, and those are going to be located in the shallower waters closer to the coastal zones. But there's an awful lot of dark, deep water out there for something to certainly be residing in. Now, there are fascinating creatures that grow to great size on the bottom of the ocean. You know, everything from the colossal squid. You have giant crabs down there. There's the isopods. If you're not sure, I've never seen an isopod. You can think back to your childhood and you can remember those little pill bugs. They kind of look like a 14-inch version of that.
Yeah.
There's massive tube worms living down there that actually have adapted to living off the volcanic vents in the bottom of the ocean. So, you know, it kind of goes back to that earlier question about, you know, the cosmos and what might be out there. Well, what we're discovering every single year more and more is that life is very adaptable. And life can succeed in places that you would never think that it could succeed. And also we tend as human beings to use our five senses and put a box around what life actually is.
Yeah.
And we try to define it as best we can. But in reality, you know, we don't really know much more about it than we do outer space as far as the deep oceans go. Now, Megalodon, no, but there are very large sharks that live in deep, deep water. If you've never heard of the blunt-nosed six-gill shark, it is a very large shark that really hasn't changed in its evolution over the last 200 million years. It still has a very old shark form to it. It gets up to 16 feet, 1,300 pounds, and it can be found as far as 6,500 feet deep in the ocean. Up in the cold zones, in the Arctic zones around Greenland, Canada, Norway, you have what's known as the Greenland shark, which is, you know, 8 to 14 feet on average, but has been seen all the way up to over 20 feet. And that lives anywhere from 0 to 4,000 feet in the ocean. So, I mean, every single year we're discovering more and more about what might actually be down there. And I'm sure you probably heard it said before that we know more about outer space than we do our own ocean.
It seems to be the case.
And, you know, to a certain degree, that is true because it's so hard because of the pressures and the temperatures to pierce really deep down into that ocean and see what exactly is going on down there at the bottom.
Yeah, most certainly. You know, what are the cases that I brought up from cryptozoological lore? I mentioned in the last hour, I'd put a bug in your ear that I might mention this one tonight just as well.
Mm-hmm.
It is the Meade-Waldo Nichols observation. Now, for those who have been listening to the program, of course, you're already familiar with this one, hence I won't go back over it, but you know, I will reference it and cite that those of you who have not read this account, I certainly recommend a article that appeared in the late Mark Chorvinsky's strangemag.com. I think that that article is still available online. And what it involved was a sighting off the Brazilian coast in 1905, if memory serves, of, I mean, what for lack of a better term was described as a sea serpent. Another famous case was that of the Daedalus serpent that was seen by Captain McQuay from aboard the sailing vessel HMS Daedalus. I think that was 1848 when that was observed, and that was somewhere off the coast of the Cape of Good Hope. And at the time, Sir Richard Owen, who was, again, probably the leading paleontologist at that time, and, you know, as understandably, you know, would be seen even today among paleontologists, he was the devout skeptic. But what was described by McQuay and those aboard the Daedalus was a large lizard or snake-like creature that was swimming through the water with, they said, what was either seaweed or like a fin or something along those lines on its back. And they observed it from the bow of the ship for a number of minutes. Meade, Waldo, and Nichols, at the time of their sighting, a good, let's see here, that would be 57 years later, I think? Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood. They thought that what they saw off the coast of Brazil very well may have been the same variety of animal described by Captain McQuay and those aboard the Daedalus who had observed this thing on another, you know, another part of the ocean. So what do we make of these descriptions? Similar though they appear to be, you know, the brownish skin, the fin on the back, the long neck, the reptilian-looking face, some liken it to a turtle, more often a turtle or a tortoise rather than a snake. You know, could there be some sort of a creature out there, a sea serpent, as it were, that may exist in the ocean? I mean, what is your personal opinion on that?
Well, looking at that particular case, the Meade-Waldo case from 1905, there's a couple of things that, as I read over it and really kind of thought about it, there's a couple things that came to mind. Now, of course, not being there, not having, you know, solid photographic evidence to base this off of, it is nothing more than conjecture, but
sure,
trying to form an opinion, what it sounds like to me is you have what's described as the fin, you have what's described as a tortoise or a turtle head. Now, for the audience out there, if you want to look this picture up, feel free, but look up a basking shark. Now, this is a very large species of shark, second only to the whale shark. But if you look at it, it glides right under the surface of the ocean most times. And it has a fin that has that frilled look to it that's often described in this particular case. And if you look at the snout of this particular animal, it has a tendency to move that up out of the water. And at a distance glance, it will look very much, or it can obviously be confused for a turtle head or a turtle shape. Now, something else that jumped out at me about this was this particular sighting with the Meade-Waldo sighting case happened 15 miles east of the mouth of the Paraíba River in Brazil. So mm-hmm. What do you have coming out of rivers is a high-density nutrient concentration. Now, these are filter feeders, these basking sharks, so it wouldn't be out of the realm for them to be swimming around in that general area because of the high density of nutrients. So just trying to put some type of effort into determining what it is that they may have seen, I certainly believe that is as good a candidate as anything else. Also keeping in mind that, you know, leatherback turtles get to immense sizes as well. However, there wouldn't be a fin, obviously, on the back of a leatherback turtle.
Right.
But, you know, as far as addressing the base of your question there, do I think that, you know, it's possible for these things to be out there? You know, all the time we're finding new species. We're constantly discovering new things. If you're familiar with the oar fish, it's a very, you know, long ribbon-looking fish often found on the coast of Japan in different areas. A very bizarre and certainly otherworldly-looking creature that by all means could certainly be confused for something like this.
Yeah, most certainly. And actually, I'll say this, too, that, you know, in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine, evolutionary biologist Gary Galbraith had supposed that what had been seen from the bow of the Daedalus ship back in 1848 had been possibly a say baleen whale, a particular variety of whale that swims with its mouth open. And when the upper portion of the jaw actually appears to protrude from the ocean, it may have been mistaken as being the long neck of a creature. And I don't know, because, again, many said, look, we could see very clearly an eye. We could see very clearly the difference between the descriptions given by McQuay, the captain, and some of the midshipmen who were aboard the deck, who had actually through the telescope there aboard the ship, had observed this creature for a number of minutes. They'd said that the difference was McQuay's description of it being serpent-like, and those of others who said it was more like a lizard. They all seemed to say that it was, whatever it was, reptilian in appearance. But then again, I mean, it could very well be that they had mistaken it for something else. Now, Richard Owen at the time had said that he thought it was like a walrus stranded on a stray chunk of ice, and that this thing was, you know, anything but what they had described having seen. There are instances where I think we have to be very careful in reading too much into how poorly observers may have, again, been able to account for, and more importantly, their recollection of what they had observed when it comes to these alleged cryptozoological cases. Again, Rupert Good, in his book on the subject, recounted more than 30 such cases in which similar descriptions of serpent-like creatures were given. You know, I don't know that that makes a strong case for the existence of a sea serpent, but I know that many marine biologists maintain that, hey, you know what, if ever we're going to find a mystery species or a potentially large species of as-yet-undiscovered animals, it's going to be far more likely to be in the oceans than someplace on land. What say you, sir? I mean, do you think that it's likely that we'll discover new species out there in the oceans, as-yet-discovered, perhaps the likes of which people have been reporting seeing over the years?
Well, I mean, it's certainly my hope. I got to say that I am a fan of the mysterious. I am a fan, and I'm always rooting for the mystery creature. I would like nothing more than for them to find, something of, especially of a large size that we just never knew, and we can all sit back and scratch our heads and go, how did we miss that? But I'm always hopeful, and I'm always willing to change my opinions on any of the creatures that we've discussed here tonight, because I would love to see proof, whether it be a giant eel, whether it be an unknown species of jellyfish or a giant squid. I mean, every year that passes, we're learning more and more about that magnificent creature. And so, I'm always rooting for the cryptid. I'm always rooting for the unknown. That really goes back to the base of where my interest in all this came from, is being able to use your imagination and having that desire that we are going to find something new, whether it be off planet, whether it be in the deepest parts of our oceans, or whether it be, anything from mystery creatures to a lost civilization. I mean, anything and everything that is a mystery is a fascination to me, and I'm always hopeful and certainly rooting for the mystery creatures, that's for sure.
Yeah. It's incredible because, I mean, we're already past the 45-minute mark. I mean, time has flown by. I got to get back down to Charleston. Paul McBay, who's been tweeting here, he lives in that area, and we may have to meet up with him at some point just as well. We could do an entire Graylian meetup. I want to hear from everybody down there in Charleston because I just love coming down there. Give me an excuse to come back down to Charleston, folks, and Jason Pentrell and I will give you an entire lecture. We'll pair up. We'll talk about this because I love this kind of stuff. It's absolutely great, and I could talk to you all night, Jason. Let's, in the final minutes here, if you don't mind, let's maybe shift gears away from the oceans because, we've talked about Fortiana and, the interest that we share in cryptozoology. I think many of us, even the most skeptical, and I know that you're very skeptical, I tend to be just as well, even the most skeptical among us certainly hope that there is more to claims and alleged reports of mystery creatures, whether that be, Sasquatch, Yeti, some sort of a sea monster, a Loch Ness monster. Dr. Dennis Tucker, who was sacked from the British Natural History Museum, was convinced, and again, one of the most educated men and probably most qualified to make such a determination, he was convinced that during the 1950s, when he visited Loch Ness on vacation, that he had seen what he said could only have been an Elasmosaurus. I'm fascinated when I hear experts in the field, far more qualified than me, autodidacticism is the term, but and I mentioned I was possibly going to bring that up. Again, those who are not as well-versed academically, but nonetheless become experts on subjects. Dennis Tucker was very much an actual expert on biology, and yet he said, look, I saw what I would liken to being an Elasmosaurus in Loch Ness. So I'm like you are, Jason. I'm very hopeful for the existence of mystery creatures out there. But when it comes to these mystery creatures, let's look at some of the land dwellers, and we'll kind of go through these in quick order. Bigfoot, Yeti, Sasquatch, skunk apes, your opinion on the likelihood that a creature like this could exist, or any general observations you may have.
Okay, great. obviously, I'm a huge fan of the cryptids. Again, it goes back to that childhood fascination that it provides, the ability to use your imagination and have that hopeful spirit for something more mysterious and bigger than yourself. When it comes to these, you know, this long list of esteemed cryptids that you just named off there, of course, you know, Sasquatch, with all the media attention, TV shows, and everything that's been given to it in the last few years, you know, there's been a lot of questions that have arose about that particular cryptid. And now oftentimes we hear the discussion of, well, if you had the opportunity, would you shoot it for science, or would you, you know, bring one in, or would you, you know, go the more humane route and just try to get drone footage or something of this particular creature? And, you know, I've got to say, when it comes to the cryptids, while I'm always looking for that scientific discovery, there's a selfish part of me that doesn't want it to ever be found, because then the mystery is solved.
Sure.
And, yeah. You know, while that may be a selfish way of looking at it, I don't want the mystery to end. I would like to have some better footage, mind you, of our friend the Sasquatch.
Sure.
other than the Blob Squatch pictures that we're all used to seeing in the bad video. But I would certainly, you know, I wouldn't advocate the killing of one of these creatures. I would certainly want to see good, clear footage, maybe taken from a drone, something like that. But, you know, I throw it back to the indigenous people of this country, who I have a special place in my heart for, through studying their culture. And when you look back through time and you can find evidence of other people speaking of such creatures as the Sasquatch or the Bigfoot or the Yeti, to me, it tends to lend a bit more credence. And then the skeptical side or the scientific side of me steps in and says, well, where is the fossil evidence? There should be something over all this time that would prove that that particular species is out there. I mean, if we can define new human ancestors off of something as small as a piece of a jaw or a single tooth or a single piece of a finger, we should be able to do the same with a creature like Sasquatch. But with that in mind, I always stay hopeful, and I certainly, if it were to be captured, I'd prefer it be captured by film and not actually physically brought in, even if that may be a selfish way of looking at it.
I understand, though. You know, I mean, I think that there's this kind of a conservationist attitude that many have just as well, which really brings to mind this whole, and frankly, at times, very ridiculous kill or no kill debate as it relates to Bigfoot. I've had people say the most ridiculous stuff as it relates to, yeah, kill one of the damn things, you know, bring it in. Well, where I stand on that point is, you know, again, if we're dealing with a potential, okay, let's just suspend our disbelief, first of all. Let's say maybe a creature like this could exist. And frankly, it's so similar to being human, frankly, that physically, there's nothing to me about it that says physically the creature couldn't exist. The problem is, how does something like this remain unseen, undiscovered, despite the advances of modern technology? And yet, I should also point out that there are species of creatures that do this all the time. And in likelihood, even marine biologists would say, as we've discussed over the course of the last hour, that in likelihood, there are large species as yet to be discovered, which have done just that. And it's one thing, I think, to be hidden in the oceans with all the depth. I mean, you know, again, with the majority of this planet being covered with salt water in the oceans, you know, for a creature to be able to hole up in the hills and remain undiscovered is a bit different, but nonetheless, perhaps not impossible, though many would say that it is. And again, we've got scientists, again, brilliant though they are, maintaining that philosophy is dead. I think that a lot of these so-called paradigms, these dogmatic worldviews, which many as in the science community have adopted, they do need to be, you know, again, questioned, challenged, shaken at times, if not stirred. And I think that with regard to the potential existence of creatures, all we have to go off of is the preponderance of anecdotal data. People who say, look, this is what I saw. It wasn't a whale, wasn't a guy in a monkey suit. You know, whatever this was unlike anything we know to exist. And yet, maybe not so. Because we look at the paleontological record, we've seen dinosaurs, you know, we've seen Meganthropus, Paranthropus, Gigantopithecus. We've seen different instances throughout history where there are things that are remarkably similar to the kind of cryptid creatures people claim they've seen today. I do think that at least in terms of their physical existence, we can say that while it may seem unlikely that they would remain hidden, the paleontological evidence, the fossil record, does show that such creatures, remarkably similar to those described today, have existed, maybe they could exist today. And I'm not trying to be an advocate or a, you know, I'm not trying to be an evangelist for cryptids, but I'm just saying, again, if you want evidence in the fossil record, there is, if not direct evidence of Bigfoot and sea monsters, there's plenty of evidence of creatures that are remarkably similar to those that are described today. Jason, look, I want to just thank you so much for coming on tonight. As is often the case, people who come on this show, if they're first-timers, they will often be contacted by others seeking to, you know, glean knowledge from them, perhaps book them as a guest on a program. How can people reach you and learn more about what you do?
First of all, I want to say I appreciate it, and it's been a blast. Time did fly by, but it's been a fantastic experience. I can be found just by looking up my name on Facebook. I also have a site on Facebook called Harvest Moon Researchers, where you'll find articles written by myself and some of my other associates that I work with. You can just look it up by using that search term, Harvest Moon Researchers. And otherwise, you can just look me up by my name, Jason Pentrail. That's Pentrail.
Thank you so much. And I want to get you involved in some of the Graylian X roundtables that we do. In fact, from time to time, I get so tired of all these podcasts that are just trying to copy the late night radio, you know, interviewee and the interviewer. I like having roundtable discussions on this program just as well, where we bring in co-hosts. At some point in the future, we got to get you on one of those just as well. I could pick your brain all night, and we're going to come down to Charleston soon, the Graylian gang and I. We're going to enjoy some fine brews and have some deep discussion into the evening hours. So I look forward to it, sir, and thank you for being on the show with us tonight.
Thanks so much, Micah.
It is always a pleasure. Jason Pentrail, ladies and gents, we'll definitely get him back on this show. So again, I guess in closing, what are we to make of the mysteries that we see in the natural world? We talk so much about space-time mysteries on a program like the Graylian Report. We talk about the divide between science, you know, whether it be advocacy or skepticism, you know, physics or philosophy. I think the only thing that we can all resolve to agree upon is that there is much more to this world than we know. And while we don't have all the answers, there are yet probably to be some discoveries that will shake the foundations of what we have thought we knew all along. I leave you with that, my dearly beloved Graylian gang out there in cyberspace, and I remain yours truly, the Doctor in the Hollow Earth, on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios. Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Racing Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, Micah Hanks. We bid you adieu, my friends. Stay strange, cosmic love. And of course, until next time, stay strange. We'll talk to you soon.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.